29. The Lieutenant Colonel's Job. Lieutenant Colonel Klementyev's hair was what is called jet black, shiny black, lying smoothly on his head as though moulded to it, divided by a part, and below his nose was slicked something like a handlebar moustache. He had no paunch, and, at the age of 45, held himself like a trim young soldier. Also, he never smiled on duty, and this made him look darker and more somber still. Although it was Sunday, he had arrived even earlier than usual. In the middle of the recreation period, he crossed the exercise yard, noting at a glance all that was amiss, without interfering, that was beneath his dignity, and went into the headquarters of the special prison, ordering duty officer Nadyalashin in passing to summon prisoner Nyerzhin and come along himself. Crossing the yard, the lieutenant colonel had taken special note of the way in which, as he approached, prisoners either tried to walk quickly by or slowed down and turned away, so as not to come face to face and have to greet him yet again. Klementyev observed this coolly and was not offended. He knew that genuine contempt for his function was not the whole explanation, and that fear of seeming obsequious in the eyes of comrades was more important. Almost every one of these prisoners, called to his office alone, behaved affably, and some of them ingratiatingly. There were all sorts of people behind bars, and some were worth more than others. Klementyev had realized this long ago. He respected their right to be proud, and stood fast on his own right to be strict. A soldier at heart, he had, so he thought, brought into the prison rational military discipline instead of the sadistic discipline of torturers. He unlocked his office. It was hot inside, and there was a stifling smell of paint blistering on the radiators. The lieutenant colonel opened the ventilation pane, took off his overcoat, sat down, armored in his tunic, and surveyed the uncluttered surface of his desk. He had not turned over Saturday's page on his desk calendar. It had a note saying, "Christmas tree?" From this half-empty office, in which the means of production still consisted only of a safe containing prison cases, half a dozen chairs, a telephone, and some buzzers, Lieutenant Colonel Klementyev, without, as far as could be seen, clutch or driving belt or gears, exercised physical control over 300 prisoners' lives and organized the work of 50 guards. Though he had come in on Sunday, he would make up for it during the work week, and half an hour early. Klementyev had lost nothing of his customary coolness and poise. Junior Lieutenant Nadyalashin presented himself apprehensively. A round red spot stood out on each cheek. The lieutenant colonel had recorded none of his numerous sins of omission, but Nadyalashin was very much afraid of him. A comic figure, round-faced and unsoldierly, Nadyalashin made a clumsy attempt to stand at attention. He reported that everything had been in order during his night duty. There had been no breaches of regulations, but there had been two unusual incidents, one of which was dealt with in a report. He laid it before Klementyev on a corner of the desk, but the report immediately took off and corkscrewed to rest under a distant chair. Nadyalashin dived after it and replaced it on the desk. The second incident consisted of the summons to the Ministry of State Security of prisoners Bobinin and Pryanchikov. The lieutenant colonel knitted his brow and inquired more closely into the circumstances of the summons and the prisoner's return. This news was, of course, disagreeable, indeed alarming. Being commandant of Special Prison Number 1 meant living on the rim of a volcano, meant always being under the minister's eyes. This was no remote lumber camp, where the commandant could keep a harem and a troop of clowns and pass sentence like a feudal lord. Here you had to keep to the letter of the law, take care not to step out of line, and never give the slightest indication of your own feelings, whether of anger or compassion. But Klementyev was like that anyway. He did not think that Bobinin or Pryanchikov could have found any irregularity in his behaviour to complain of last night. Long experience had taught him not to fear slander from prisoners. It was colleagues who were likely to slander you. Then he ran through Nadyalashin's report and saw that the whole thing was nonsense. That was why he kept Nadyalashin on. The man was literate and sensible. But he had so many faults. The lieutenant colonel gave him a dressing down. He reminded Nadyalashin at some length of all the things he had overlooked last time he had been on duty. The prisoners had been led out to work in the morning 2 minutes late. Many beds in the cells had been made up hastily, and Nadyalashin had, weakly, failed to recall the careless prisoners from their work and make them try again. He had been told about all this at the time, but you could talk as much as you liked to Nadyalashin. It was water off a duck's back. And just now, at morning exercise? Young Doronin had stood stock still right on the boundary line of the exercise area, carefully inspecting the restricted zone and the space beyond it in the direction of the greenhouses, broken ground with a gully running across it, which could be very convenient for escapers. Doronin had a 25-year sentence. He had a history of forging documents and had eluded a nationwide dragnet for 2 whole years. Yet not one of the guard detail had told Doronin to stop dawdling and to circulate. Another thing. Where had Gerasimovich taken his walk? He'd broken away from the rest and gone off behind the big lime trees in the direction of the engineering shops. Remember what Gerasimovich was in for. This was his second term under Article 58, Clauses 1A to 19, that is, treasonable intent. He hadn't betrayed his country, but he had been unable to prove that his reason for going to Leningrad in the first days of the war was not to be there when the Germans arrived. Had Nadyalashin forgotten that he must study the prisoners continually, both by direct observation and from their dossiers? Finally, what did Nadyalashin think he looked like? His tunic was not pulled down. Nadyalashin pulled it down. The star on his cap was crooked. Nadyalashin straightened it. He saluted like an old woman. Was it any wonder that, when Nadyalashin was duty officer, prisoners didn't keep their beds tidy? Unmade beds meant a dangerous crack in prison discipline. Today they leave their beds untidy, and tomorrow they'll mutiny and refuse to go to work. The lieutenant colonel then went on to give instructions. The guards escorting prisoners to meet relatives will assemble in the third room for briefing. Nyerzhin is to remain standing in the corridor. You may go. Nadyalashin left the room perspiring. Listening to his superiors, he was always sincerely distressed by the justice of their reproaches and admonitions, and vowed to offend no more. But once he resumed his routine and bumped into so many prisoners, each with a will of his own, all pulling different ways, every one of them wanting some little morsel of freedom, Nadyalashin could not refuse them, hoping that with luck it would pass unnoticed. Klementyev picked up his pen and crossed out his Christmas tree note. He had made his decision the day before. Christmas parties were unknown in special prisons. But this year some prisoners, and some of the best behaved among them, had begged for permission to hold one. Klementyev had started thinking that there was perhaps no good reason to refuse permission. It could obviously do no harm, and there wouldn't be a fire. In matters electrical, they were all professors. And it was important on New Year's Eve, when all the free employees went off to enjoy themselves in Moscow, to provide some relaxation back at the Institute, too. He knew that the eve of a holiday was particularly hard for prisoners to bear. Who knows, one of them might decide to do something desperate, something stupid. So the day before, he had rung the chief administration of prisons, to which he was directly subordinate, and sought their consent to a party. Prison regulations forbade musical instruments, but they could find nothing about seasonal parties, and so neither expressly approved nor flatly forbade it. Long and impeccable service had given Lieutenant Colonel Klementyev an infallibly sure touch in all his actions. So, on his way home, on the escalator in the metro, he had reached his decision. All right, then. Let them have their party. As he entered the compartment, he thought with satisfaction that he was no mere rubber stamp, but an intelligent, efficient, and indeed a kind-hearted human being. Not that the prisoners would ever appreciate it, or find out who had wanted to ban the party and to whom they owed it. The decision, once made, made Klementyev feel good. Instead of pushing and shoving his way into the compartment like the other Muscovites, he stepped in last, just before the doors closed, and made no attempt to grab a seat, but clasped a stanchion and watched the blurred reflection of his gallant self in the mirroring window, beyond which the blackness of the tunnel and the endless pipes with cable sped past. Then he shifted his gaze to a young woman sitting near him. She was neatly but inexpensively dressed, in a black artificial Astrakhan coat and a cap of the same material. A bulging briefcase lay on her knees. Klementyev looked at her and thought that her face was pleasant but very tired, and that she showed an indifference to her surroundings unusual in a young woman. At that moment, the woman glanced in his direction, and they looked at each other for some time without expression, as casual fellow travellers do. But suddenly the woman started, and Klementyev glimpsed an anxious question in her eyes. As his profession required, he had a good memory for faces. He recognized the woman, and his look betrayed it. She noticed his hesitation, and was obviously confirmed in her own conjecture. She was the prisoner Nyerzhin's wife, and Klementyev had seen her on visiting days at the Taganka prison. She frowned, looked away, and glanced again at Klementyev. He was now staring out into the tunnel, but out of the corner of his eye he saw her watching him. Suddenly she made up her mind, rose, and moved so close to him that he was compelled to look at her again. She had gotten up, looking determined, but then her courage seemed to fail her. She had lost the independent air of an emancipated young woman riding in the metro. It looked as though, in spite of her heavy briefcase, she meant to give up her seat to the lieutenant colonel. Hers was the heavy lot of all political prisoners' wives, wives of enemies of the people. Wherever they went, no matter to whom they turned, if their unfortunate marital status became known, they were branded with their husband's indelible shame. In the eyes of the world, such a woman shared the guilt of the double-dyed miscreant to whom she had rashly entrusted her future. Such women, indeed, often began to feel as guilty as the enemies of the people themselves, whereas their hardened husbands did not feel guilty at all. The woman moved very close, so that her question could be heard over the clatter of the train.
"Comrade Colonel, please forgive me. I believe that you are in charge of my husband. Am I mistaken?"
A great many women of all kinds had risen and stood before Klementyev in the long years of his service, and he saw nothing unusual in their anxious timidity. But here, in the metro, although she had addressed him very circumspectly, there was something unseemly about the woman standing before him in supplication with all those eyes upon them.
Why are you standing? Sit down, sit down.
No, that doesn't matter, she said,
her eyes fixed on the lieutenant colonel in urgent, almost fanatical entreaty.
Tell me, please, why I haven't been allowed a visit? Why I haven't been able to see him for a whole year? When will I be able to? Please tell me.
Their encounter was as improbable as that of one particular grain of sand with another 40 paces away. A week earlier, permission had been received from the prison's administration of the Ministry of State Security for certain prisoners, among them Nyerzhin, to see their wives on Sunday, December the 25th, 1949, at the Lefortovo prison. But there was a footnote forbidding notification of the prisoner Nyerzhin's wife post-restant as he had requested. Nyerzhin had then been called in and asked for his wife's real address. He mumbled that he did not know. Klementyev, trained by prison regulations never to tell prisoners the whole truth, did not expect frankness from them. Nyerzhin, of course, knew but wouldn't say, and it was obvious why he wouldn't. For the same reason that the prison's administration would not accept post-restant as an address, because notification was sent by postcard with the words, "You have been granted permission to visit your husband at such and such a prison." Not satisfied with having the wife's address in its records, the ministry did its best to reduce the number of candidates for such postcards by seeing to it that all the neighbors would recognize the wives of the enemies of the people. They must be brought out into the open, isolated, hemmed in by the right-thinking public. This was what the wives feared. Nyerzhin's wife did not even use his surname. She was obviously trying to hide from the Ministry of State Security. So Klementyev had told Nyerzhin that there would, of course, be no meeting, and had not notified his wife. But now the silent attention of all around them was fixed on this woman who had demeaned herself by rising and standing before him. "Writing post-restant is forbidden," he said, just loudly enough for her to hear above the racket of the train. "You have to give an address." Her expression changed rapidly.
"But I'm leaving soon. I'm leaving very soon, and I have no permanent address now."
She was obviously lying. Klementyev's intention was to get out at the first stop, and if she followed him, to explain to her in the entrance hall, where there would be fewer people, that such discussions could not be permitted outside official premises. The wife of an enemy of the people seemed, in fact, to have forgotten her inexpiable guilt. She looked into the lieutenant colonel's eyes with a dry, hot, pleading look, a look inaccessible to reason. Klementyev was astounded by that look. What force made her cling so obstinately and hopelessly to a man whom she didn't see for years at a time, and who could only ruin her whole life?
"It is very, very important to me," she assured him, wide-eyed, trying to detect any sign of wavering in Klementyev's face.
He remembered a piece of paper lying in the safe at the special prison. That piece of paper, developing the order on the reinforcement of the rear, aimed a fresh blow at relatives who declined to give addresses. Major Mushin intended to read this document to the prisoners on Monday. If this woman didn't see her husband tomorrow and didn't give her address, she might never see him again. Telling her here wouldn't amount to a formal notification. It wouldn't be on record. It might look as if she had turned up at Lefortovo just on the off chance. The train was slowing down. All these thoughts passed quickly through Lieutenant Colonel Klementyev's head. He knew that the prisoner's worst enemy is the prisoner himself, and that every woman's worst enemy is the woman herself. People cannot keep quiet, even to save their skins. More than once in the course of his career, he had been foolishly soft, permitted something forbidden, and nobody would ever have known, except that the very people who had benefited from his indulgence had thought fit to tell the world about it. He must not be weak. Not this time. All the same, as the train noise subsided and the coloured marble of the station flashed into view, Klementyev said to the woman, "You have been granted permission to visit. Come at 10 a.m. tomorrow." He did not say to Lefortovo prison, because passengers making for the door were too near. "Do you know the Lefortovo wall?" She nodded, overjoyed.
"Yes, I do."
And suddenly her eyes, dry a moment ago, were full of tears. Anxious to escape those tears, expressions of gratitude and any other superfluous talk, Klementyev stepped out onto the platform to await the next train. He was surprised at himself and vexed. He need not have said it. The lieutenant colonel kept Nerzhin waiting in the corridor of prison headquarters because he was an insubordinate prisoner, always the barrack room lawyer. After standing there so long, Nerzhin had indeed not only given up hope of a visit, but, accustomed as he was to all sorts of misfortunes, had begun to expect some new horror. He was all the more surprised to learn that he would be going to meet his wife in an hour's time. The exalted code of conduct that he constantly inculcated in other prisoners forbade any sign of joy or even satisfaction. He should have casually inquired exactly when he should be ready and then left the room. He considered such behavior essential to prevent the authorities learning too much about the prisoner's mentality and gauging the effect on him of their actions. But this was such a sudden reversal of fortune, and his joy was so great that Nerzhin could not help beaming and heartily thanking the lieutenant colonel. He, by contrast, did not move a muscle. He went immediately to brief the guards who would be keeping the prisoners and their visitors company. The briefing included a reminder of the importance and top-secret status of their establishment, an explanation that the political offenders going to see relatives that day were inveterate criminals, and that when allowed visits, they were solely and obstinately intent on passing the state secrets to which they had access directly to the United States of America through the intermediacy of their wives. The guards themselves had not even a rough idea of what was being developed within the walls of the laboratories, and it was easy to plant in them a holy dread that a single scrap of paper passed to an outsider might bring the whole country down in ruins. Then followed an enumeration of the main possible places of concealment in clothing and shoes and the techniques of discovering them, though clothing, respectable, special clothing, was issued 1 hour before the visiting time. By means of question and answer, the Lieutenant Colonel made quite sure that the instructions on body searches had been firmly grasped, and in conclusion they studied, with examples, the turns that conversation between prisoner and visitor might take, practicing listening in and interrupting all subjects except personal and family matters. Lieutenant Colonel Klementiev knew the regulations, and was a lover of order.